Author, historian, academic, Zorawar Daulat Singh, welcome to India, Russia and the world.
Thank you. Thanks so much for hosting this.
Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, he's been on a series of diplomatic tours, Pakistan, Oman, then Russia. He held talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin as well. What do you think is driving this sudden round of diplomacy?
For the last 10 days since the ceasefire was announced, there have been these attempts at finding some kind of a post-war peace. The terms of negotiations is where both sides were kind of reaching a stone wall. Pakistan tried to play this mediating role.
Do you think that's gone nowhere?
Yeah, it's kind of, I think the impression generally we get by listening to the Iranians is they were really urging the Iranians to accept the American kind of framework as such. And I think the Iranians have kind of reached a dead end with that. And I think they also wanted to signal that if a confrontation were to be more prolonged in a different form, you know, even if the war kind of maybe subsides and you have a containment plan, I think that's where the Americans want to go, squeeze Iran like they squeeze Iraq or Syria for decades or half a decade. That's where I think Iran knows that it needs bigger partners. It needs a stable, long-term partnership, and Russia is the primary sort of a player for that. I mean, they share a Caspian border. Russia sees Iran as, in a sense, a second front of its struggle with the West. So there's a lot of commonalities where geopolitical circumstances have brought these two major regional powers now. I mean, you have a great power, and people are saying Iran could be the next major power. So this is a tipping point in many different facets, not this visit as such, but just the way this crisis is unfolding and Iran is being able to hold out and stake its position and not compromise on its vital existential interests.
But do you think then the Islamabad talks, the mediation, that is over?
Very little, to be honest, a mediator can do in this position. I think here it's about the Americans. Are they willing to have a honest conversation and a dialogue that accepts the Iranian point of view as a starting point? And one of the interesting things we're seeing, again, we don't have enough confirmation, is possibly the Iranians are putting across a variety of ways to make an offer quite attractive. Because I think there's a belief now and an impression in Iran and even elsewhere that the Americans are not prepared for a second round. And they may do it, but they know that they are going to get battered as well. And the global economy will get battered. So Iranians want to, I don't want to use the word exploit, but yes, exploit the conditions for peace that still exist by making some kind of a peacemaking framework that allows Trump to also sort of claim a little bit of a win.
I was interviewing the Iranian ambassador to China. He told me that the US does not want a peace deal. What they want is Tehran to surrender. Do you think that at this point, the US is operating on ego?
They just cannot believe that you have a regional power which is ostensibly much weaker at a comprehensive national level that has actually stared them down, but not just stared them down in rhetoric. They actually have clear material advantages as you get closer to the Iranian periphery. Like, they wanted the Venezuela 2.0 to play out in Iran. That was the premise. That was the illusion where, you know, it's a juggernaut and it's unstoppable. But that is kind of now looking very, very, I mean, it's a ridiculous proposition, right? Even if you listen to American mainstream former administration officials, who part of the American establishment, they are saying that Iran holds big cards, good cards, and they can't be wished away. So this is American mainstream strategists who know that the game's up.
Many of the NATO powers are also not supporting what the US is doing in Iran today.
So I think let's look at it this way. If the US had succeeded in those first few weeks or the first week of Iran, they would have all joined like vultures into that conflict. I'll take you back to the German Chancellor was in the White House, I think within the first few hours or the days of the Iran conflict, and when it wasn't unclear what was going to happen. And he practically made a statement, I think we can check it, where he called for pretty much on the lines of the US perspective, where, you know, that the time has now come for big changes, so to speak. I'm paraphrasing. So this kind of realism on Europe or NATO's part is really that they don't want to get caught in the crossfire. They're seeing the US has really played a hand which has backfired very badly. So this is by no means a breakdown in US-European unity as such. And we've seen that when it comes to capturing states and exploiting the spoils of war, so to speak, as Trump calls it, they will take their peace if they get it.
From watching the development so closely, who do you think wants peace more? Is it the US or is it Iran?
If you look at the last even 2-3 years, all of the major rivals in the region have been eliminated, right? Or nuisances. Libya is gone, Iraq's gone, Syria is gone. And a lot of this, especially the Syrian fall of Assad, was in some sense was a retreat of the Iranians as well from that theater. So I think what was seen by Americans was, now look at Iran, it's retreating into its national shell. It is now literally on its last legs.
Yeah.
So they went in with quite a logical premise that, you know, they've lost the region. Their proxies are weaker than they were 10 years ago. They don't have any allied partnerships, you know, a treaty alliance with the Chinese or the Russians. Their domestic capacities were underestimated. So all that kind of gave this impression that this is the time. The time is ripe to make this move. And because Iran falls, that entire region from the Mediterranean all the way to the Indian Ocean becomes an American lake. And so by not falling, and by not just not falling, by actively projecting power, you have altered the course of history in some sense.
US President Donald Trump, he's called India a hellhole. And then he wants India to buy American oil. He also wants India to back his Indo-Pacific strategy in the region. Insults in the morning and then favors by the evening. How do you define this diplomacy?
Indian policymakers now truly need to reconcile what's actually happening. You know, on the one hand, you have very clear US policies that are undermining Indian interests at every level, right? It is, you could call it containment, or you could call it, whether it's in the region, whether it's in the periphery, whether it's your trade, tariffs, energy security, geopolitics, Pakistan. On every aspect, the facts and the empirical evidence suggest that the US approach to India is not what it was, let's say 20, 25 years ago, where a strong, prosperous, rising India was seen as a vital interest for the US in Asia. We have a misplaced sense that these are transient trends, that ultimately America will go back to what it was after Trump. The world will kind of stabilize. I think that is a completely naive and a delusional perspective. And it's not shared by everybody in India, but that's the mainstream policy approach, that you buy time, you appease this kind of vicious predator, and eventually you will find stability in it.
But then, are you saying that Trump has, in a sense, permanently dented the US-India relationship?
I think the US-India relationship simply cannot go back to what it was. Even that original premise was always based on a promise that a strong, independent India will do things for America which will benefit America, and vice versa, right? And it was, I think, based on a misplaced set of expectations that India will be this most allied ally of Asia, right? Which Indians, were they prepared to do that? There was never a national debate in India for that. Your national identity has told us that you're not that kind of a power. You're not a frontline power. You're not a proxy power. The quid pro quo to India was that, okay, we'll give you technology, we'll build up your military, we'll give you access in immigration. Your entire landscape will change. Now, the American side of the bargain can't happen today because they aren't able to give those deliverables.
I want to talk about Russia and Iran. Both are under Western sanctions, both targeted by American aggression. Both are trying to build alternatives to the dollar system. Do you think the Russia-Iran partnership is something that the US needs to worry about?
Absolutely. If they define their interests where any kind of a non-Western power has a say on regional security, on the global economy, on energy trade, all the stuff where it was entirely controlled through, let's say, Washington or London, metal exchanges, energy exchanges, that, of course, will be seen as a challenge, right? So, which is why we are seeing these conflicts. But I think the Russia-Iran partnership on the geoeconomic side needs a lot more partners to also come in into that picture, you know, because you have big players like India, China, who are big consumers of energy. And ultimately, they have to be also part of this bigger shift if you want to not just create, supplant the US economic order, but have a framework that is at least going to allow many sovereign states to have choices. So, and ultimately, isn't that what the BRICS was all about?
India is hosting the BRICS presidency this year. The BRICS forum, the BRICS platform, amidst the West Asia crisis, is it fragmented? Is it fractured and broken? Or do you think that when India hosts the BRICS presidency, it gives a platform for major powers to come in and talk to each other?
I think ultimately, just the necessity of events, of energy security, of having to maintain domestic economic growth, industrialization, having a set of public goods in global finance that cannot be weaponized at will. These will bring what are still, let's say, differing interests to come to some common framework and common consensus. India has the most to gain from a multilateral framework that gives it stability in even its most narrowest form of national interest, if it defines it, which is having your economic stability at home, having your 20, 30, 40-year journey of you know, trying to sort of build yourself up. You can't do that if you don't reform the international setting. So BRICS is an instrument to get there. I think at times what we see is, again, you are pandering or you're responding to Western frameworks or propaganda that want to belittle BRICS into a completely trivial institution that is hostile and it is engaged in geopolitics and etc. So you've got to look at your own interests and play your role in BRICS. And it's a big responsibility for India. And it's more than just drafting joint statements or communiques, right? And I think Indians, are, again, we ourselves now need to step out and play a role, not just for world order, but world order and which will suit your domestic order and your domestic development. And there again, there's work to do.
Are we already witnessing the early contours of a post-Western global order? Or do you think that this is overstated at this time?
The process, historical process, has begun. It's begun through conflict, it's begun through resistance, it's begun through major military struggles. But at the same time, you have a parallel narrative out there that is saying that this is not just a contest for power. You know, it's not like, okay, US had power and now we're going to blunt that power for it to be going into somebody else's hand. We're going to change the very framework of rules and norms and institutions that are going to be more inclusive, that are going to cater to the global majority. I mean, you've got all this discourse is there. It's rich and people are espousing this for multiple global South states. You've seen all these states, if you aren't able to collectively come together, you will hang separately, right? So if you are not being sanctioned today, you're indirectly paying the cost of those sanctions, right? So whether it's on energy security, you look at the Russian oil, you look at even Iranian oil, you look at even technology access.
Yeah.
You want a diversity of choices, right? Ultimately, that's what you want. Every state wants that option to choose, and then it can have its own internal integration where it creates a diversified network.
Many analysts that I've been speaking to, they all have the same theory that once the dust of the war settles down, Iran will emerge as this new power in West Asia. How do you see it?
So let's put it in a more reasonable frame. A major regional power with a great power potential is certainly where Iran is heading. And for India, I would even go further in saying that having a West Asia, even though you have very strong ties with the Gulf states, with Israel and the whole US sort of sphere of interest, you also have Iran, right? And you always claim that that is an important civilizational partner. You were just biding your time for Iran to come out into the open. If you're going to have now a more plural West Asia, it's good for your broader interests, your regional security, your connectivity into Eurasia, all those aspects.
In the recent years, we've seen that the West has sought to isolate Russia, while India, it continued its engagement with Moscow. And I'm talking about after the war in Ukraine started. What areas do you think that India and Russia have scope in to further strengthen their bilateral relationship?
One of the things I found when looking at India-Russia ties, it actually across sort of world orders, you know, you had the Cold War phase, you had the second phase of the Cold War, which was the phase of the Grand Partnership, the Indo-Soviet partnership against the Sino-American coalition that had come up, which of course was the what we all remember, right? The partnership that brought a new world order to the subcontinent in 71, and high tech technology, Indian military power by the 80s had reached a level of capacity where it was being seen as the future great power. Yeah. Cold War ends. Despite that phase, you see Indians and Russians keeping their links at the very, very strategic level alive. And you've had a continuity from the Kremlin for the last 25 years, which has made it easier for them to understand. But even from India, where despite so many turnover of regimes, governments, bureaucracies, I think it tells you something, right? That this is not a partnership just built on transactionalism or circumstances, right? I mean, if it's been there for 70, 75 years, there must be something deeper.
But on the other hand, we also see Moscow is moving closer to China. Does that in any way complicate India's calculations?
So at one level, yes, if you are only playing a China hand or your entire foreign policy is focused just on China. Though even there, I would argue, and facts have shown that the Russia-China relationship, when it comes to the India-China, let's say, military competition or military conflict potential in the Himalayas, has played a stabilizing role, right? After Ladakh also, the Russians played a very important mediation role behind the scenes in stabilizing. So the Russians have a vested interest in having stability between India and China, because both these, for their own grand purposes, are important partnerships. I think where the opportunity lies for India is, you know, you had this RIC concept where Russia, India, China. And again, a lot of it is framed through a Western eyes, right? Okay, these three Primakov triangle is coming alive and, you know, a lot of it. But ultimately, who are the major players in Eurasia? Now you could add Iran to it as well. But these are the four big players of a greater Eurasia, where regardless of what they're doing collectively, it doesn't have to become this grand coalition, but they are the stabilizing players for the next 100 years, right? None of these civilizations are going anywhere. Also, let me just add, the Russia-China partnership is very important from a world order perspective. And it's aimed ultimately at containing and resisting US Western unilateralism, right? That's the main purpose behind it.
Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, they recently entered into this new defense pact, this agreement. And many look at it as this NATO-style alliance. Does India need to worry at all?
So now it's looking less efficacious, right? I mean, this was all pre-Iran. And now in hindsight, in fact, it all kind of makes sense, right? In 2025, we see a lot of frantic activity happening in the Middle East, West Asia, where Pakistan is being sort of, you know, brought in into many of these mini security architectures, which resonated with what used to happen in the Cold War. And people are wondering that what is this all about? And as we saw then with the June 12-day war, 2025, December attempted color revolution, this was all linked to the build-up of the Iranian crisis. There was obviously a plan that this is the next play, and Pakistan had to be on side, so to speak. It's just that the Pakistanis, when they again see things going haywire, they kind of they don't want to be caught up again, like NATO. Yeah. Who wants to be caught up on the wrong side? So they kind of cleverly lap up the first call from Trump to provide the US a face saver and extricate the US, which is in their interest too, right? A weak US, a weak Central Command, a weak Pakistan army. That's really how the equation goes, right? Which is why I keep, when you speak to Indians, horrified at what is Iran doing to the Gulf and Israel. Ultimately, a strong Iran means Pakistan is balanced and there is stability and diversity in that space, right? So because the forces that have propped up your existential military rival in the subcontinent are the ones that are losing in the conflict with Iran. So there's no ambiguity to this.
You have written extensively on India's grand global strategy. What is India getting right and what is India getting wrong?
So what India is getting right is that it's saying all the right things in the last 10 years, particularly after the 2008 global economic crisis. We look at the Indian discourse. It's recognizing that the post-Western world is now finding its feet, it's growing, its aspirations are growing, it's wanting a say in so many different aspects of international order. And then you have the phase where actual military struggle takes over between the West and these non-Western powers. So I think for India, it's seeing that multipolarity is now becoming a reality and it's saying that it wants it. What it's getting wrong, I would say, is the pace of change that it speaks ostensibly, it's not acting upon at a policy level across the board. That's where you see a mismatch between what you say and what you're doing.
If you had to define India's core geopolitical objective in one line, what would that be?
I would say to decolonize your mind, decolonize your entire way of thinking about world order, that you are a distinct civilizational state and you're not just a part of the old Western community because of colonialism that, you know, had created these new modern nation states. You go back a much longer way. So and from a material sense, of course, bringing the fruits of development to the vast majority of Indians and a sense of stability and security in your neighborhood. I think these are the core geopolitical sort of goals which will animate Indian policy for this whole century.
And we've seen in India's neighborhood a lot of these protests and then so-called Gen Z protests, which ultimately led to regime change. Does India need to change its strategy when it comes to dealing with its neighborhood and the new leadership in the neighborhood?
So India actually has been quite a responsible regional power for decades, right? It hasn't been, I mean, the counter argument has always been that India has been this hegemonic power. It tried to suppress its neighbors. If anything, it's been the mildest form of what a regional power can be. Yes, there have been instances of interventions and where it's tried to favor certain regimes. But on the whole, today the argument could be that India has retreated from playing a role in stabilizing the neighborhood, which is why you're seeing a lot of the smaller neighbors kind of get swayed, not necessarily by their own domestic conditions, which is fine, but you have other powers that are playing a part in shifting the local equilibrium. So, and if you are just watching it and not playing your part, you're seeing it happen across the state. So abdicating in the form of being this benign regional power is also not good. And maybe we've swayed the other way. So bring India back as the main player to bring development, security, stability to the neighborhood. I think that's where it should be the next sort of course for Indian policy.
My last question, what is that one opportunity that India must not miss?
I think the opportunity you should not miss is that after centuries, you have the non-Western world that's rising today and the stranglehold of the West over all aspects of international life is now opening up a new avenues and many different futures, which are still being scripted. Are you going to play a role in writing those scripts and shaping that future? Or are you just going to just parrot the old discourses? That's the biggest opportunity. I think your worldviews today have to give expression to a lot of the uncertainty and opportunities that exist.
Sir Rawardalat Singh, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks so much.